it is just wonderful to be back in Oregon. And over the last 15 months, we've traveled to every corner of the United States. I've now been in 57 states. I think one left to go.
Catapult of propaganda. The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
The highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And that makes me Sharon Gilbert, everybody. Welcome to the bunker. It's Monday, May the 12th. We are one day late, and we apologize for that, but doggone it, yesterday was Mother's Day.
We're not going to apologize too much. Hopefully you were spending time with your mother, or at least giving your mother a call, letting her know that you remembered her and appreciate all of the time, blood, sweat, and tears that she put into making you the person you are today.
Amen to that.
Yep.
And we had the traditional Mother's Day pizza yesterday.
Yeah.
We have pizza on a lot of occasions, and you know what? I love that.
Yeah, well, it seems like
it means we don't have to cook, and somebody brings us the food, and we just sit down and eat, like, well, a couple of hogs.
And it was okay with me, too. So we had an interesting guest last week on PID Radio, and we'll get to her in just a couple of minutes. We got a couple of things we want to blather about as we kind of do a wrap around the interview today.
That's right. We have Katie Thompson coming up in a bit. Normally our interviews are 55 minutes long or so. We weren't able to get that much time with Katie, so we're going to tell you what we think of the world before you get to hear her.
But that actually works out well because there are some things that we want to talk about. So
there are, and some of those things relate to what we discussed with Katie.
Absolutely. So we'll be talking quite a bit today about our food supply and how safe it really is, and the cost of food and why the cost is going up and how it's going to affect us. Of course, this is something we touched on within the last couple of weeks as we discussed the supply of food, and it's coming scarcity as predicted and prophesied by
We have been talking about this for years. Saying that you really need to get some food set aside because the prices are going to go up. Well, we're seeing them go up now. They're skyrocketing in the stores. And we do get into that with Katie, but we also get into foot and mouth disease, which is the very thing that she studied before she wrote her book, Dead Stock. And, of course, as we said last time when we were teasing this show, teasers that we are, the dead stock relates also to commodities trading. But first, we got to talk about some of the news in the weather and earthquakes and all kinds of terrible things.
In and around the mainstream media's coverage of Jenna Bush's nuptials and the ongoing soap opera that is the Hillary Clinton-Obama race, of course, you've heard that Myanmar has suffered losses that to this point haven't really been losses of human life that are mind-boggling in scope. We've heard estimates anywhere from 25,000 up to over 100,000.
I've heard at the very least 50,000 who are dead and missing. That number is really very quickly escalating up. BBC is now saying it could be as much as a million people.
Which is just astounding when you think about it. And even more astounding is the lack of attention really being paid in the American media to what is a tragedy of historic proportions.
This is Katrina level, and maybe even worse
Katrina.
Than that.
Oh, absolutely.
At the very least, it's Katrina level. But as far as the death, Katrina, the people in New Orleans did not have that many deaths. They had way too many, but the country called Myanmar, the country that calls itself Myanmar, country formerly known as Burma. The interesting thing about that is when President Bush talked about Myanmar last year and the year before, he started on this road of we've got to make inroads. There are human rights violations taking place against the Buddhist church out there. The monks were protesting all over the place the way they have been in Tibet and in China. At that time, President Bush was referring to that country as Myanmar. But you now hear them say Burma. In fact, our press has returned to Burma. It's called the Burma event, the Burma tragedy.
Yeah.
I think it's an in-your-face to the dictator who is in place in Myanmar. It's the U.S. saying, okay, we're not playing games with you anymore.
Yeah, the military leadership there is very insular and has been very leery of letting outsiders into the country, to the point that they shut down really any media penetration into the country there, which is partly responsible for the tragedy. The people who lived there only had, a day or two notice that a cyclone of epic size was headed right its way.
I'm not sure they had. I think it was less than a day.
Yeah.
India is saying that their weather service alerted the country 3 days at the very least before that hurricane struck the shores. And if you go to a site that's called Mimic, and I love to look at storms there, it's the site where we saw that unusual fingerprint for some of the storms that hit the U.S. a few years back.
Right.
Mimic has a file that you can watch where you can actually watch the storm as it approaches. It's just horrifying. I cannot imagine what it must be like for the people there, because it's more than just they're without homes, they've lost family members. There are corpses all over the beaches.
Right. It is, again, it's a horror show. And
and they're getting no food, because the food that's being delivered, the aid that's being delivered, is being confiscated and sold.
You know, it was so the similar events that took place in Somalia when aid that was being sent by humanitarian organizations was grabbed by the warlords there and sold on the black market, that finally made me realize what Jesus meant when he said, the poor you will always have with you. I used to think, boy, that's an odd thing for God to say. I mean, couldn't he just wave his hands and say, you know, everyone's got enough to eat and just take care of it? Or couldn't we as people, in striving to become more holy like God, overcome poverty? Well, no, it's not a problem of distribution. It's a problem of sin. There will always be those who will exploit the poor and the downtrodden and keep them that way. And we're seeing more evidence of that in Myanmar as the aid is not getting where it's supposed to go. What little is being allowed into the country? One plane. Thank you very much. We were trying to send more in, but Myanmar has allowed one flight from the United States, and I don't know how much else from the rest of the world.
Well, there are lots of people in the world that are trying to help, so don't stop helping.
No.
If you want to donate, if you want to help, don't hold back because you think that it's not going to get to them. Eventually it will. But many prayers for those people and for the people in China.
Right. The death toll as of this afternoon, and again, this is Monday, May the 12th of 2008. As of this afternoon, the death toll is estimated to be near or slightly above 9,000 as an earthquake above magnitude 7 struck one of their provinces, southwestern provinces, today. So, again, just another horrific event as we see the earth going through what can only be described as birth pangs.
I think so. And as we get closer and closer to the precipitating event, what I believe is going to be the rapture of the church. And we're going to be talking with David Lowe about that this week. He'll be on next weekend's PID radio show. Yep, we're going to talk to him about his book, Earthquake Resurrection, and how it relates to events we're seeing in the news, not just the China earthquake, but the cluster that we've seen around, Verde Mogul in Nevada?
Just outside Reno.
Oh, they have had, a day doesn't go by that they don't have dozens.
And scientists are puzzled. They said this doesn't fit any pattern that they've witnessed in history. It doesn't fit any model that they have for, you know, what few they have for predicting earthquakes. So they're really at a loss to describe or to explain what's going on in western Nevada. But if you look at the USGS website, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes at PIDradio.com, you'll see that there's just a cluster of ongoing earthquakes ringing just west of Reno, Nevada. And people there are getting very nervous because, again, scientists can't explain it. They don't know why it's not going away. These aren't like aftershocks that are like the echoes from the ringing of a bell that gradually fade away. They're continuing at roughly the same intensity. And there's just no real good scientific explanation for what's going on out there.
Unless they're precursors to something
could
bigger.
Could be precursors.
To come. Or, you know, there are theories out there that they may actually be man-made. So I'm not really sure. There's a pattern out there that's a little, it just doesn't look like it's natural, if you know what I mean. We are trying to get someone to come on and talk to us about that, more about that in the future. But Illinois is another area that had some earthquakes. Alaska's been having them ring off the hook up there over and over. Honshu, Japan, mm-hmm. has had a lot of earthquakes lately. And we've got the Chilean volcano that came to life after, what was it, 2,000 years or something?
Something like that, yeah. So it's now the Ring of Fire, which includes the Aleutian Islands in Japan. You kind of expect that to shake and quake, and volcanic activity in that Ring of Fire. You know, more or less, there's always something going on in that area. But Illinois, eastern Illinois, I mean, mm-hmm. southwestern Illinois, when you're getting close to the New Madrid Fault, you kind of expect some quakes there. But the eastern Illinois, where the quake hit a couple of weeks ago, which we felt here southeast of Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. That was a little unexpected.
It was. And then there was an earthquake just south of where we used to live in St. Louis.
Yeah, that was a little unusual, too. In fact, that was very close to the old Walmart that we used to shop at down there in Fenton, Missouri.
Yeah, I love that place.
So that was, again, just some odd things taking place around the world. But, of course, the things that happen here in the U.S., although we notice them because we're close, they pale by comparison to what's been happening in Asia over the last couple of days. So, again, your prayers for the people of Myanmar and China. I want to touch on one political event that I think has some very significant implications in the United States. It's a story that's gotten a little attention in the media, but not nearly enough. And there hasn't been the kind of outcry that we would have expected from the patriot community. Mm-hmm. Because this is a clear and...
Or at the very least, the libertarians. I mean,
and the libertarians.
They don't always go hand in hand.
You may have heard about April 3rd's raid by the state of Texas against the compound occupied by the Fundamental Latter-day Saints Church, the FLDS. This is the group that was headed by Warren Jeffs, who's now in custody. And the Texas Department of Children and Family Services raided the compound on April 3rd. They were armed for a Waco-style confrontation. They had armed personnel carriers there, men dressed in black wearing body armor. Nothing happened, thankfully, but the upshot of all of this was that they basically kidnapped 463 children and took them away from their parents on the basis of a phone call that now appears to have been fraudulent, a phony phone call that was traced, we believe, and authorities believe, to a woman in Colorado who has a history of making phony calls for help like this. Now, the warrant that was issued that led to the raid, the warrant which was based on this phone call, has been dropped. That was dropped last week. The fact that this warrant has been dropped, the fact that the supposed 16-year-old who made the phone call has not been found or identified... And again,
because
we believe,
it was the Colorado woman.
We now believe it was actually a 33-year-old woman in Colorado who made the phone call. The fact that this warrant was dropped has not motivated the Texas authorities to return these children to their homes. Now think about that for a moment, if you will. The United States Constitution says under the Fourth Amendment for law enforcement to come into your home, to conduct a search, they have to have probable cause, and a warrant has to be issued detailing what they are looking for and why they believe they have a right to look for it. There is no warrant now because the warrant was dropped, but the children are still being held and kept away from their parents. 463 children. Now comes news that mental health workers who were sent to emergency shelters in Texas to help care for these women and children have filed 8 reports and have been very, very critical of Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services, in response, has apparently threatened workers, these mental health workers, some of them anyway, with arrest if they didn't quit interfering. So basically what we have here is a case in which hundreds of children have been taken from their homes on the basis of an anonymous, probably fraudulent phone call, no warrant, no cause, and yet the state is still holding these children. This is a very dangerous precedent and one that Americans need to sit up and take notice of. But it's a convenient test case for the government because the FLDS, a polygamous cult, mm-hmm. doesn't have many friends in our modern culture.
No, it doesn't. But let's stop it for a minute, as you say, and let's really take a look at what's going on. I would venture to believe that most of the people listening to this show right now would agree that polygamy is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do. I believe that polygamy is wrong. Well, not scriptural. It all depends on what you mean by that. It is in the Bible.
It is in the Bible.
Because Jacob, at the very least, had 2 wives.
Right.
And there are other occurrences.
David had many wives.
Exactly.
Solomon had many wives.
Solomon had way too many. Way too much. But we are told by Jesus that originally man and women were designed to be one man, one woman,
right.
one wife, one husband.
Matthew 19. Look it up.
Good job. So I don't believe in polygamy. I think it's wrong. But are we not a country that allows religious freedom?
Mm-hmm. Allegedly.
Allegedly, yes. So even if this is illegal, why did they wait this long to do anything about it? Now, I realize that Warren Jeffs has been on the lam and he was finally arrested and this and that. But what bothers me the most about this is that this was all done on a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
No real probable cause. This was a phone call.
Right.
That's not how I understand our justice system to work. Otherwise, I could call and leave an anonymous tip and say, you know what? I heard that those people three houses down are engaging in illegal activities. Well, what are they doing? Well, there's a child at risk.
Yeah.
Oh.
Child abuse, possibly.
Yeah.
And
suddenly their
children,
kids are taken away on an anonymous tip.
And this isn't the first case. There's a case in Virginia, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes because we don't have much time to cover it. But essentially, a parent, a couple there has just within the last year, a judge ruled that they are not entitled to have their 2-year-old daughter returned to them.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter was taken from them on the basis of an anonymous tip to Child Protective Services in Virginia, even though they were cleared by Child Protective Services in Virginia, because the judge ruled that returning the child at this point, after being separated for 2 years, would be too traumatic.
And we may well see the same activity taking place here because these kids are still, as you say, in protective servants. And I'm putting little quotey marks around protective because I'm not so sure. And these kids, my understanding is that regardless of whether they're in polygamous, you know, families or not, these kids, this is all they've known. And they're actually very loving and have been treated with great love and respect. Mm-hmm. Now, you can differ with me on that. I haven't talked with these kids. I'm only quoting what, or paraphrasing, what I have read in the articles. But most Americans look at this and they wouldn't, oh no, well, that would, they were right to go in and take care of that. Take them out.
Yeah.
But what if they do the same with you homeschooler parents?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, someone called and said that you're engaging in child abuse.
You're teaching your children to hate and disrespect.
So we're taking your children away.
Right.
And in fact, we understand that you associate with a number of childhood, homeschooling parents.
Mm-hmm.
We probably should go and take their kids away too.
Children who are being denied the social benefits of, being around other kids in a school setting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Since there's no hue and cry, no outcry about this from the public, I would assume that if this is indeed a test case, that they're delighted that the government, the shadow government, whatever you want to call them, that is very happy that no one's saying anything. It's that old, you know, the Nazi thing. Well, they came and they took away this group and I didn't say anything. And then they took away the next group and finally they came for me.
And there was no one left to speak up. And so that's why we're raising this issue now. And again, we'll put links to the articles documenting and reporting on what's happening here in Texas. And again, somebody needs to stand up. Now, did you want to get into
I wanted to just bring up one thing before we bring the interview with Katie Thompson in. Katie, writing under the name of Kate Iola, of course, has written a book called Deadstock, which talks about foot and mouth disease and how it very easily could change our entire economic structure if used as a terrorist act. Today, and actually it was 4 days ago, an article came out from Associated Press talking about how sotto voce, which means, you know, quietly under the breath, so to speak, the right to choose whether or not this NBAF facility, the biological hazards facility, is going to be rebuilt at Plum Island or on the shores of the United States. That has been under the auspices of the Agriculture Secretary. Not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
A deal was struck late last week that it would now be the DHS that gets to decide. The Department of Homeland Security wants it off Plum Island and here in the United States. They want to bring all of these dangerous viruses and biological elements such as foot and mouth disease and study them, quotey marks, on our American soil very close to the cattle farmers. How much sense does that make?
Not a lot.
Now, foot and mouth disease can be very easily transmitted. You can carry it on your shoes. You can carry it on your clothes. It can move on the wind. It can get into water supplies. So if you have it anywhere near a cattle supply, that's a bad idea. Well, the Congress, in fact, it was the head of the Senate Agricultural Committee, the Republican leader, I should say, has made this deal along with one other, and it's an anonymous person who has struck this deal with the White House, will give this decision-making power over to the DHS. In other words, we're going to let the DHS determine things that the Ag Secretary should be determining. I'm not even sure the DHS knows what they're talking about when it comes to agriculture. In exchange for that, they're supposedly going to get George Bush's signature on the new farm bill. May I point out that the Republican leader of the Ag Committee is from Georgia, which is a state that is one of the finalists in getting the new NBAF facility, which means lots and lots of money to construct it. The states are for it, but I tell you what, not in my backyard, not near my farm. And saying that,
we go now to our guest line here in the bunker, and joining us is a woman I've had the really the pleasure to talk to several times, because she's really a wealth of information on a topic that affects all of us, and it's not one that gets much coverage in the major media. Her name is Katie Thompson. She's written an excellent book called Dead Stock under the pen name Kate Iola. And Katie, we're just really happy to have you here on PID Radio.
Thank you, Derek and Sharon. I am happy to be here.
Oh, we're so glad to have you in the bunker, so to speak. I have wanted to talk to you for a long time. I read your book, Dead Stock. It's fabulous. If you don't have a copy of it, people, we'll put a link to it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Are there copies still available, Katie?
Absolutely.
Oh, good, good. Are you writing another one?
Yes. In fact, I have most of the sequel completed. I have a completely different agriterrorism scenario that
I've put
together, and I can't wait to get that out. That should be coming out sometime in 2009.
Well, we'll definitely be looking for that, because not only is Dead Stock real enough to be very chilling,
it is right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Really good.
But it's a ripping good yarn with very well-developed characters. And you're hearing this, Katie, from a couple of people who fancy themselves to be fairly adept with a word. So it's I can say this from knowing Sharon for over 10 years now. She doesn't impress easily, and she is impressed by your writing. So.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, and I can't wait to read the follow-up. For those people who have never read Dead Stock, maybe haven't listened to the interviews that Derek did with you back in Colombia, can you give us a little bit of your background, Katie, and also just really quickly give us a synopsis of Dead Stock?
Okay. My background is that I'm trained as a scientist. I have a master's in molecular pathology from the University of California, San Diego. But when I moved back to the Midwest, I switched over into writing and started working as a journalist. And one of the first things that caught my eye as a journalist were stories about international disease outbreaks. Since I was living in farm country now, I started to see the potential disaster that was waiting there. A lot of people hadn't realized how much money is at stake in American agriculture. And so the combination of my technical background and my new agriculture business awareness really put up some red flags for me, and I fairly quickly focused on the idea of trying to tell the story of one of the big potential disasters, which was an outbreak of foot and mouth disease. So I then spent 5 years trying to figure out how to write a complex story about economic disease disaster in a way that people would actually want to read. And so that resulted in Dead Stock, which is a novel about a disease disaster.
Well, it even includes more than that, because it also, as you hinted, includes the commodities exchange.
Yes. One of the concepts that really started to hit me as I was working on the plot for the book was that there are motives people don't usually think about for someone who's a terrorist. And one of those motives is profit. The commodities market involves a tremendous amount of money exchanging or changing hands every day as people buy and sell grains and the right to own grains. And if you disrupted that with the kind of disease scenario that I described in Vet Talk, if you disrupted that and you put yourself in the right position to start with, you could make a tremendous amount of money. And this is a plausible scenario. It's not a purely fictional possibility. So I definitely wove that into the story as a major motive of my villain.
Now, you've been at the FBI's symposia on agroterrorism the last couple of years. The most recent one was the third week in April in Kansas City. How seriously does the FBI, does the U.S. government take the threat of agricultural terrorism?
They do take it very seriously. In fact, this conference is a new series. They've only had this now three times, this large conference, to bring together people who are concerned with agroterrorism and would deal with it if there is such a case here in the U.S. And the discussions were quite serious during the week. It's a different kind of experience for me to be sitting in an audience of FBI agents that are most of them armed. It's not the usual audience that I'm used to hanging out with, but these people are very serious about the subject, because if there is some kind of a disease outbreak like the one in my novel, or something that's directly targeted at a food production facility, a potato chip factory or something, if it's deliberate, then the FBI is going to be a major part of the investigation, and a disease hot zone would become a crime scene. So they are definitely making significant efforts to be sure they know what's going on and what they have to do and who would have to do what.
Well, I need to ask you a question about foot and mouth disease. I'm a scientist as well, but I honestly don't know the answer to this one. I assume you will. How is human hand, foot, and mouth compared to the foot and mouth disease that cattle get?
Is it a similar virus? Yes, that's a good point, because I have been reading about this hand, foot, and mouth outbreak.
Over in China, yeah.
It's in China right now. It is a totally different virus. It's the hand, foot, and mouth affects humans, whereas the foot and mouth doesn't affect humans. And they each result in a disease outbreak, but the human version is more of a conventional human disease outbreak, whereas mm-hmm. the livestock version that I talk about in Deadstock, really the ultimate impact is because of an economic crisis. So they have different consequences.
Well, I assumed as much, but I know that we've got very savvy listeners out there, and I know that they're aware of the Chinese problem right now. My understanding is that hand, foot, and mouth is usually caused by an enterovirus, and EV71, I think, is the one that's going around over there. But I know that our listeners want to make sure that if cattle show up with foot and mouth, that they don't need to worry about their kids.
That is a really good point, and you're exactly right. It's not a human threat. And in fact, some of the early foot and mouth disease researchers deliberately tried to infect themselves by consuming a full gallon of contaminated milk, and they still weren't able to infect themselves. That's a whole different kind of situation than with the hand, foot, and mouth so-called virus.
So what is it that causes the economic impact of foot and mouth disease in livestock?
For foot and mouth disease, that's when the commodities markets are so heavily involved. The biggest problem with foot and mouth disease is that we don't want it, and so we'll go to extreme measures, and rightly so, really, to very quickly shut it down. Because we don't have a real treatment for it or a really effective vaccine, which you'd have to have used ahead of time anyway, really the only way to stamp it out is to destroy its populations, which sounds awful, but in the realities of agriculture, that's what would have to be done. And so the impact is to not only immediately push to stop the outbreak, but also to stop the spread of it by stopping exports. So this is an extremely highly regulated disease. You wouldn't have the same kind of impact with other diseases where, boom, the same day, exports will be shut down. That's a unique consequence of foot and mouth disease because we have agreed with other countries that we don't want to spread it if we get it.
So if, say, local cattleman, say in Kansas, has a herd that shows up with foot and mouth disease, not only will his herd likely be destroyed, but possibly surrounding herds? Is that how?
Highly likely, yes, highly likely that surrounding herds, plus every other state in the country that has cattle, would immediately not be able to export beef, cattle, milk, hogs, cheese. Those all are stopped immediately because all of those different forms can carry the virus, and other countries that don't have it don't want it.
How contagious is the virus in spreading from, say, one herd to another?
It can travel on the wind for 25 miles or more. It's actually been shown to travel 35 miles, and it can travel in mud, especially if it's frozen. It can last indefinitely in frozen mud. So it's really very contagious.
Good thing mud never freezes in Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, the Dakotas, Minnesota. Yeah.
I was just picturing the boots of, say, a vet going from ranch to ranch or farm to farm. You know, you can hose off your boots, but they could still harbor virus that have gone into some sort of a dormant state and then reactivate once they get into the cattle.
Or deer moving from farm to farm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
The best thing we have going for us is that geographically we're a big island. We work and put a lot of money into helping Canada and Mexico stay foot and mouth free. So North America is a big foot-and-mouth-free island in the world. Pretty much everywhere else in the world has it.
Now, your novel, Deadstock, you really describe a nightmare scenario with states closing off borders with a state with an infected herd. A couple of years ago, the state of Kansas ran a simulation to sort of model what would happen if a foot-and-mouth outbreak were to occur. And in their model, the National Guard, Kansas National Guard, used so many bullets putting down herds around the affected farms that in their simulation, they ran out of ammunition. Is that an accurate scenario? Are we talking about piles and piles of dead livestock? And obviously,
well,
that's
some
what
of these ranchers have
from.
Thousands of head of livestock.
Sure, but thousands upon thousands of head of livestock dead and waiting to be buried somewhere.
Yes, it's so hard talking about the realities of this because there just isn't a pretty ending, and this was actually a real struggle for me in writing the book because there just is not a happy ending that I could have. And, but yes, right now we do not have a good vaccine for foot and mouth disease. And so the only way for us to deal with an outbreak is to end it quickly. And the way to do that is to, what they call depopulate, to destroy herds.
Mm-hmm.
There's not such a thing as quarantine and letting them develop immunity. You don't get immunity to this. I've seen people make crazy comments like, oh, we'll just let go through the country and they'll all get immune. Well, these are people who don't have any concept of biology or immunology. If, as a country, we decided that we were going to accept foot-and-mouth disease in the country, which would cause us to have really impaired agriculture, we could do that because animals can survive, but they're scarred for life then. So right now, at the FBI conference, for example, one of the things, one of the big topics was, again, planning. How are we going to handle a response to a foot-and-mouth outbreak? Who are the different agencies that will be involved? Who's going to be in charge of dealing with carcass disposal? Where are they going to go? Is it going to be burying them, or is it going to be burning them? It depends on if, what the water table is where you live. Mm-hmm. In Kansas, one of the plans is to bury them along interstate medians.
Wow.
That ditch in the middle. That was one of the more creative ones I'd heard of. In Iowa, where I live, a lot of the area is too wet, so you couldn't bury. You'd have to burn, but, and people talk about composting, but that's, I don't know if you've done composting, but you have to manage a compost heap and turn it, and that's just not...
That's a gruesome thought. You've got cattle out there that you're trying to turn. That's gruesome.
Yeah, I have real issues with composting just because it takes management to do it properly and not harbor live virus. And so I could get in a nice debate over that one.
Well, it isn't just live virus. You also have all the hormones that are in the cattle.
You'd have a real mess.
Oh, yeah, those could leach into the groundwater. What would be the economic impact of this?
So then you have the direct impact, which is the loss of the animals, loss of income. For a lot of the farms who were counting on income from animals, you could have foreclosure of, you know, on land mortgages that they would have had to pay. But then you have also the secondary effect. If you don't have cattle or you think you're going to be losing your cattle, you may not be buying grain or planting the grain. You have planted the plan to plant. So the prices on – this is where the commodities markets come in. The prices on the Chicago Board of Trade and in London and Mumbai, every place that trades corn or soybeans, which are major parts of livestock feed – those prices are going to fluctuate like crazy as people start to speculate on how many animals are going to be there to consume feed.
So we're go ahead.
Well, a lot of people don't realize the scale of money that's involved. We have a very stable agriculture system in our country, and a lot of people don't realize the amount of money that's moving through commodities markets on a daily basis and what the impact of the disruption would be. So that was part of what I've learned from Alan Kleist, my commodity trader advisor for the book, and who I dragged along for the interview.
Well, If Alan's got a minute or two, maybe this would be a good point to put him on so we could talk about a little bit about the impact here. I mean, we've discussed a little bit, and we will put links in the show notes at PIDradio.com to the other interviews that you and I have done, Katie, about the vulnerability of America's food supply chain to terrorist acts. And we've covered that pretty well, I think, in a couple of other interviews, but suffice it to say that it's chilling. Especially when you read Deadstock, as to how easy it would be, no more difficult than throwing some infected manure into a feedlot in order to start a chain of events that could literally cost the American economy billions of dollars. But the impact, of course, doesn't just stop with the money that's traded on the exchanges, the money, the impact on lives from those who depend on producing food. And, of course, the consumers whose lives would be affected by the prices and the availability of food.
The beef on your table and, of course, all the farmers, as you say, who would lose their livelihood.
Well, the beef on your table and the money in your mutual fund, I think, could all be affected by an outbreak. And that's something for Alan to address. Certainly in the time since my book has come out, it's become a larger vulnerability because of the increase in value of corn mm-hmm. and soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever if you're ready, I can hand you over to Al.
Yeah, if he's there.
Okay, here he is.
Well, don't go away. We want to wrap up with you before we leave today.
Hi, Derek. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Alan. Thank you for joining us. You've been trading?
Glad to be with you. I've been trading for 34 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And so
you're the one.
Well, you've seen a lot of changes then, I would imagine, over the years. But over the last couple of years, we've seen just a real spike in the prices of just basic grains that are important to not only feed humans, but to livestock as well, and thus indirectly to feeding humans.
Oh, yeah.
What is going on out there in the world, Alan, that is driving up the price of food? And how vulnerable?
No, let's do a basic question first. There may be people listening who have no idea what we're talking about when we talk about commodities and futures and things like that. I grew up in the country. I grew up listening to those reports every day on the radio. What are commodities and why do people trade them?
Okay, commodities are grains initially. It's where we started trading commodities in the United States, the Board of Trade. And you trade them for future delivery. So if you were growing corn, you could sell your corn ahead for December of 08 or even December of 09. Mm-hmm. And they started publicly trading exchanges for these commodities, corn, soybeans, wheat, soybean meal, were the first ones that really caught hold. There was benefit to both the farmer and the food processor because they could know what the farmer would know what they were selling it ahead for. The end user, the wheat miller, the grocer could know what they were buying it for. So they did the futures trading, and they agreed that where they would deliver the product, standard grades and location, the month you would deliver. And the only thing that the exchanges really provided was liquidity, where you would trade it, and then also the price discovery, what you were willing to buy, what you were willing to bid it at, or what you were asking for it.
Okay. But now people who have nothing to do with farming get in on this deal. And they're not necessarily buying to take delivery. They're buying because they figure they're going to make money. Yeah, without ever touching corn or anything.
Oh, yeah. Since 2002, it's really been a whole new ballgame. We've seen commodities viewed as an asset class. And so you have the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. You've got the Deutsche Bank Ag Commodity Index. And they're coming in there to buy commodities thinking, and there are projections which have been correct, that commodity prices are going to move higher. They don't ever intend to feed one bushel of corn, process one bushel of soybeans. It's purely an equity play in which they come in there, try to buy something, anticipating that it's going to go higher. These funds have been blamed for higher commodity prices, but they really don't have any net impact because every bushel they buy as a commodity speculator, they eventually have to resell. So they can cause some short-term volatility, but all they're trying to do, and they have been certainly on the right side of the uptrend in commodity prices.
Okay. Well, I think that gives us at least a fair, background. And I'm glad Sharon is here because she, I think, approaches this a little more common sense. Let's get the groundwork laid before we start
always
building the structure.
Always get your definitions.
Yeah. I tend to just jumping ahead, try to, start with the end. So now back to my question, Alan. What is it that's driving prices higher? Is it just a natural function of supply and demand, or the decline of the dollar, or is there something else at work?
The commodity markets rally usually go in three phases, and what we've been through primarily since 2002 has been demand-driven. India is eating a lot better, China's eating a lot better, and so they have this huge demand for more grain and more protein, so they're needing to buy a lot more soybeans at a time when their ability to buy is increased at the same time. So the biggest factor that's from 2002 till now, Derek, has been just the increased purchasing power of foreign consumers who want to have a better diet. They want to have more food, and they want to have larger populations in those areas. So that's been a big part of it. At the same time, we've seen the dollar get very weak. So the dollar from a year ago till now is down about 12%. If you look at soybeans at $12 a bushel right now, roughly $1.40 of that price increase has been because of the lower dollar value. On corn, we're looking at corn futures trading $6.30 a bushel, and a 12% decline there is worth about 70 to 80 cents per bushel. And then third factor has been that we've had some really disappointing crop yields throughout the world. Wheat prices exploded first. We had a major production problem in the U.S. hard red winter wheat crop last year in Kansas, Oklahoma through Texas. Smaller wheat crops in Ukraine and Russia and Australia. Europe had a disastrous crop, and so we saw a limited number of bushels being produced at a time when demand was surging, and wow, all of a sudden prices just exploded.
What would be the impact of an act of agricultural terrorism or an unexpected disruption like the one Katie describes in her book Dead Stock?
It would be very negative for prices. In commodities markets, you can make money on the short side just as fast as you can make money when prices go up. And that type of disruption in grain demand and the ripple effects it would have would take initially grain and nearby livestock futures sharply lower. One of the things we look at in the industry is something called ACUs, animal consuming units, and you try to project feed usage. And right now, we're feeding a lot of cattle, a lot of hogs, a lot of broilers. And if something really hit that took a lot of the cattle and hog producers out of business, they stopped feeding grain, you would go from a very tight supply-demand situation to a surplus situation overnight, and you would just see prices crash lower initially in grains. Eventually, it would affect many of the publicly held companies like John Deere, big banks that are borrowing money to the farmers, Tyson, Smithfield, all of those would be impacted. So it would just be, I think, a major financial debacle that would be led lower initially by the commodity markets.
Are we talking millions of dollars, billions?
Billions, hundreds of billions.
Hundreds of billions.
Right now, when you look at the U.S. corn crop, you know, projected to be about $12 billion, 12 billion bushels. If you take a dollar a bushel off of that, you take from a lot of people from being a decent profit to a loss. So initially there's $12 billion off of the gross income to farmers. Soybeans, you would easily take them from 12 probably back to $8 a bushel below the cost of production. They're not able to pay their loans. That has an impact on the demand for seed and fertilizer for next year. It certainly has an impact on the availability of credit and trucking, tires, everything. It just ripples all the way down through.
How many Americans do you think right now have commodities in their portfolio, whether they know it or not, looking at their mutual funds, 401ks?
Most of the people that have money invested, you know, like through CalPERS, California Pension System, any type of major investment fund has between 3 and 5% of their retirement invested in commodities. And so it's huge. It's massive. The Goldman Sachs Commodity Index alone has assets now of about $260 billion. And if you look over the last, since 2002, and especially the last 3 years, commodities have outperformed both bonds and equities. And so we see just a surge of money coming in because most people invest looking backwards, not forward. Mm-hmm. And there's just more and more money coming in all the time. So if you have a well-balanced portfolio, there's a good chance that you have between 3 and 10% of your future, you know, of your mutual fund investments allocated to commodity investments.
So people who have no idea that their lives are somehow tied to the agricultural sector could be affected by something like the scenario described in Katie's book, or a scenario that keeps FBI and counterterrorist experts awake late at night.
It would be a major impact initially, especially for, you know, the heart of the country. We're producing a lot of food and fiber. We have a lot of ag-related companies. It's a huge impact that it would have all the way through. And it would eventually hit both coasts because, you know, Goldman Sachs Index is a New York firm, and they have, you know, $260 billion invested into it. It's been their top-performing asset the last 3 years, and you can just see where if that starts to go the other way, how quickly it could. And for a lot of the farmers that have leveraged themselves, bought higher-priced land, new equipment, all of a sudden it's just going to tank things.
It's hard to even imagine how America would look after those ripples hit the edge of the pond. It's, that would touch everyone.
Well, I think it would be the 1980s over again. More and more farmers having to sell out.
That's correct, Sharon. You would see a lot of people that have, you know, bought expensive land, leveraged themselves to buy more equipment, and just the whole cost of farming. A lot of people, you know, look at it from the city and look at $6 corn or $12 soybeans, and they have the false assumption that farmers are getting rich doing that. But we're paying $4.25 now for our diesel fuel. Mm-hmm. The cost of fertilizer has jumped by 40 to 60% in the last couple of years. So all of a sudden, we need those higher prices just to make any kind of profit at all. And if something happened that took commodity prices sharply lower, you would have, a situation, Sharon, worse than the 1980s, because there's so much more debt right now and so much higher asset values, so much more money at risk.
You know, you're probably right on that. I was farming in Nebraska back in the 1980s, and there were still so many farmers around us who were really, really careful, you know, old school kind of thinking, and they didn't want to go out and buy that brand new combine. I suspect that there are lots of young farmers right now that are sitting on huge piles of debt.
That's correct. Anybody who went through the 80s meltdown, in which you saw your land value drop by two-thirds in value, you saw your ability to repay loans, you're conservative. I'm in that school. I mean, you look at things a little differently when you see asset values going down instead of up all the time. But for many of the people that have started to farm in, say, the last 10 to 12 years, it's been up, up, and away. And history says that's not realistic. It's not going to always go that direction.
Oh, rats.
Well, Alan, being prepared is half the battle.
Well, we appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule. I know that night markets are open even as we speak, and you've taken some time out of your evening to share it with us, Alan, and we appreciate your insight. And
we'll have to have you back on to explain some other things to us.
Well, I appreciate your call, and sure enjoy working with you. I'll pass it back to Katie. Thank
okay,
you for your
thanks,
time.
Alan.
And we'll make Good sure night. That we... We'll make sure we put a link to Alan's website in the show notes at PIDradio.com so you can look in and see exactly what commodities traders do and get some interesting photos of Alan, by the way, at his website, too. Trading with his cell phone from various parts of the globe.
What a world.
Yeah. Not a bad job to have, I guess, if you're going to be able to do it. You know, you can do it wherever you are at the time, which is why we like doing this, so we can sit here and...
We do indeed. Do we have Katie again?
Yes, I'm here.
Just very quickly, Katie, the topic that first brought us together was the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. And I know you're short on time, so we don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it popped back up in the news again just recently. Congress apparently has finally taken notice that the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, rather, wants to build a replacement for the laboratory at Plum Island, which is currently the only lab that studies foot and mouth disease, somewhere in the middle of farm country. What are your thoughts on that?
I still have big problems with the concept of moving that very sensitive facility into the heart of farm country. Foot and mouth disease, like I've been saying, is a really special case because of the extreme impact. And putting the only place that works on that in an area that has farm vehicles driving by is not a good strategy. The arguments for it from the people who are pushing for it are that it's difficult to get people onto the current Island Research Laboratory, but that's the whole point of isolation, to make it difficult for the virus, in fact, to leave the island.
Well, the research facility, it's on Plum Island right now, and didn't I see that they're considering just revamping Plum Island?
Yeah, they've added Plum Island now to the list, the final list of potential sites to replace Plum Island, which... is probably the best idea. Do we need a laboratory to study foot and mouth?
I'm sorry, did you say do we need a laboratory?
Yes, why do we need it?
Yeah. Because we need a vaccine. Once we have a good vaccine for foot and mouth disease, we'll be able to vaccinate, and foot and mouth disease will go the way of smallpox and other viral diseases that, at least in this country, we're able to avoid through vaccination. Right now, there are some inadequate vaccines which are used in other parts of the world that make an effort to have some kind of a livestock industry. but they also are kept on this sort of blacklist of FMD-infested countries that are not allowed to trade with the FMD-free countries like us. So we need to have a laboratory so that before we get it by accident or by design, we can vaccinate. That's the main reason. There also is a diagnostic facility, which is on Plum Island. So if you suspect that an animal at your farm may have foot and mouth, that's where the sample goes to be tested. That even could be moved to the mainland and wouldn't be as high of risk. But the research lab that does the vaccine research has to work with entire groups of infected animals. Mm-hmm. And the amount of virus that they shed is just tremendous. So that, oh, please, I hope that stays on Plum Island. Otherwise, I'm going to sell a lot of books.
Well, we hope you sell a lot of books, but not for that reason.
Yes. And yeah, where do people go to find copies of Dead Stock and your other writing?
They can go either to my website, which now could be either kiola.com or katiethompson.info, or they could go to Amazon and order through Amazon.
Oh, wonderful. Well, in case you missed that, we will put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, links in the show notes, and we will stay in touch with Katie Thompson, also known as Kate Iola, the author of the book Dead Stock and a number of other projects. We'll look forward to the follow-up novel, which, again, even if you're not as interested in the security of America's food supply and just want a really good thriller, Dead Stock comes highly recommended. Katie, thanks for taking time out of your evening to join us on PID Radio.
And thank you guys so much. I've very much enjoyed this.
We'll have show notes on everything we talked about, links to everything we talked about in the show notes at PIDradio.com. And, of course, you can discuss it at the Piercing the Darkness Forum, and you'll find a link to that in the show notes as well.
How about that? And if you have any comments you want to send to us, that address is radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
In a kingdom that will last, they'll make a way across your wilderness. Like a river flows in desert land, there's a new day coming, a new day coming now, there's a new day coming. Oh,
news and analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.